express how delighted I am to be here with you today and how honored I am to share with you some thoughts on the perception, the understanding, the hermeneutics of normative texts. And I'm really grateful that I can be part of this music and human rights symbol. You may notice that I'm not mother tongue English. You definitely can notice difference to the beautiful English Julian speaking. If you may notice an accent familiar to a certain actor, that's definitely not on purpose. Well, people tell me sometimes that I sound like Arnold Schwarzenegger. I prefer that they tell me my language is similar to his than anything else. I really don't like him as an actor, and even not more than as a politician. So I hope you know understanding for my English. What I would like to invite you is, as we are quite the size of the groups allows that, that you really please interrupt me every time you don't understand anything, or if you are not agreeing with me, that's going to be more interesting even. So please share your critical remarks, your comments immediately. Don't wait until 1 o'clock, because at 1 o'clock we're all going to be hungry and already heading for lunch, at least mentally. So please really interrupt me, because then it's really getting interesting. And as I'm coming from Switzerland, to use another stereotype, I will be still in charge and responsible for keeping time. So don't worry about that, we're going to finish tomorrow morning. We're going to finish it in time. But please really interrupt me, it's really more interesting for all of us if you do that. And I still will go through the program I've planned to do with you. I will start with, the first part of my presentation will be on hermeneutics. So the understanding of how we can read, how we can understand text. So the technique, the concepts behind how do we perceive texts. And one important element in that is that we have to look, and now my handwriting is really bad, so that's worse than my English. So, but you listen, you hear it, so you can, it should just be a reminder of what I'm saying. The first step would be that we should look in a hermeneutical approach to normative texts, we should look at the development of these texts. What kind of context influenced the development of a normative text? In the case of, to make it more concrete, in the case of human rights, if you look at human rights, not only starting from the Universal Declaration of 1948, but really looking at ideas which you can find in the history, going far back, already having elements of ideas and concepts which are familiar and close to human rights, you can tell that human rights are often thought similar to human rights, ideas very close to human rights, are reactions to experience of injustice. I'll give you one concrete example. Antiphon, a Greek philosopher, 500 before Christ, he was struggling with the reality of slavery. He was experiencing slavery, just walking on the streets every day and seeing slaves, and says, well, that's not right. That's a reality we can't accept. And based on this experience of injustice, he wasn't experiencing it on his own body, but at least he was feeling it with the slaves, or he was feeling it with the victims of this experience of injustice. He started to think about, to reflect upon what is slavery about and how slavery is actually against the idea of equality of humans. He, based on this experience of injustice, he developed a line of argumentation why slavery is not acceptable, why it is not morally legitimate to distinguish between free humans and slaves. And probably nowadays philosophical discourse, his line of argumentation wouldn't still be acceptable anymore, because it's based on a naturalistic fallacy. A naturalistic fallacy is that you describe something empirically and derive from that directly a normative statement. So in his case, he said, well, we all breathe the same way, we all eat the same way, we all sleep the same way, and therefore we must be treated equally. Now you see the empirical description, which probably would be shared also today, but then the step in between is missing, leading to that normative statement. But still, what I want to show with that example is, if you look at the development of normative texts, in the case of human rights, I would argue that they are reactions to injustices occurring in reality. People try to fight them. People try to find reasons how they could argue that these injustices need to stop. So therefore it makes sense to look at, if we have human rights declarations, human rights documents, it makes sense for our understanding of these documents to look at the context, the historical reasons why these texts were declared, drafted, defined. I'm not saying that's the only thing we should look at, because of course this historical understanding of these texts has also its limits. What kind of limits would you see if you just look at the historical development of a normative text? I know it's hard. That's a hard question for a Friday morning, but still. Who wants to try? Yes, please.
I think because it's based on the experience.
Yeah.
And your experience may be different from mine.
Exactly.
So it leads to the different understanding of the right that I perceive from myself.
I couldn't have done it better. It's the perfect answer. So your experience, my experience, the experience of another person, the experience of Antiphon, you know, of the slavery reality, can be different from other ones. So it is subjective. It is also historical contingent. What I mean by that, it is hard to make the step from an individual experience of injustice to a universal norm. Like, for example, I can feel treated unfairly by, well, I'm falling in love to somebody and maybe this love is not getting any adequate corresponding response. I can experience that as experience of injustice. Well, probably I'm the only one who would judge that situation as an experience of injustice. And in legal terms, that can be the same situation. I can feel treated unfairly because I can't afford a Ferrari. Is that really something which is a matter of universal concern? Hopefully not. So we have to make then a step from this historical, subjective, relative experience of injustice to universal norms. So that is one limit of looking just at the historical development of normative texts. Do you see other problems? Well, that's the last time I'm helping out. The other problem is that you can't justify a normative text just by explaining its historical genesis. So, for example, explaining why slavery is ethically unacceptable cannot be done by just explaining the genesis of the abolishment of slavery. You know, just stating the reasons why this was done historically. That's not enough, because somebody could still step up and say, well, but I'm totally in favor of slavery, and that can be the historical genesis, but that doesn't really answer my questions why this shouldn't be the reality. So the explanation of the historical genesis, the analysis of the historical development of a normative text, doesn't have any justifying dimension. It doesn't have a justifying impact from a normative perspective. For a normative justification of a legal norm, of an ethical, of a moral norm, you need reasons. Reasons which live up to the expectations we have on a critical moral theory. So when I state slavery is unacceptable, I need to give reasons why this is the case. Now these reasons have to have a certain quality. So they can't be just historical saying, well, but that was done like this for years and therefore we have to continue this way. Why is this not acceptable as a moral justification? Because the expectations to a critical moral theory are that these reasons are so-called good reasons. What are good reasons? Good reasons are reasons which are, if we imagine that all people, imagine, it's not like they make this global referendum, even coming from Switzerland. It's a model of thought. If we imagine we have a moral referendum, like we have a global referendum, everybody could speak up autonomously, freely, and it would be imaginable and possible that they would agree on these reasons. So, I give a concrete example in the human rights discourse. If we say, again, coming back to the slavery example, if we say, well, slavery is acceptable, because that's the statement, and the reasons for it is because slaves are stupid, and therefore they need to be slaves. This reason is obviously probably not acceptable for, in a model of thought, for all people. At least the slaves would be against, and hopefully also some others. You see my point? And you can play that with other patterns of exclusion. With patterns of exclusion, I mean, for example, discrimination of men and women, often based on reasons which similar. You know, people would say, well, women are not competent to fulfill such a role in society. It was the case, for example, in the area of political participation. And there you had also reasons as the fundament of these kind of stupid assumptions, which wouldn't have passed this test of really bringing up good reasons which are acceptable for, imaginable that they would be acceptable for everyone. Yes, please.
Are you suggesting at one point in time they may have been seen as good reasons? That even women would have spoken up and said, in 1600s, is a good reason.
Probably, I would say no. I think what probably more you would probably explain such realities rather in having a setting where women, for example, but also other people weren't free enough or weren't autonomous enough to speak up. But still, it's interesting. I mean, well, we come back to that later, to this pattern of exclusion, because it's not something which is really just happening in history. It's really happening nowadays as well, just with different kind of groups. So we have to look at that closer then afterwards. Yes, Julie.
But you're saying if we could imagine everyone voting and freely, that they would be in favor. So in the end of the 18th century, there was her name Wollencroft, this woman who espoused equality, and there was one in France and one in Great Britain. The one in France ended up being beheaded. But maybe a lot of women would have harbored the same feeling, but didn't feel they could express it. But yet, if everyone could vote, would they say, well, I shouldn't even vote because I'm only a woman? And I'm trying to understand a little better.
I think what could be helpful for your question is that you really have to imagine this model of thought as something where real people are free and autonomous without any power relations, without any pressure that they aren't allowed to speak up.
I see.
And in such a kind of really model of thought situation and setting, what would be the outcome? Would they accept this reason or this reason? Mm-hmm. So it's really kind of detached from reality, basically. It's really in a theoretical setting.
Okay.
Just as a test, as a criteria, if this could be a plausible reason for a moral affirmation. Mm-hmm. So far, so good?
Yeah.
Then let's do the next step. If you look at the context of how normative texts were developed, we need also take into account that normative texts, in front of all legal normative texts, distinguished from ethical or moral normative texts, are results of an opinion-forming and decision-making process. In a democratic setting, people are put are able to participate in opinion forming and then decision making processes. And therefore, often legal normative texts are texts of compromise. I give you one concrete example. If you look at, and we come back to that declaration later, if you look at the UN Declaration on Human Rights, Education and Training, if you look at Article 1, at the beginning of the process, preparation, drafting process of this UN Declaration, it stated everyone has the right to human rights education. That was beautiful, everybody understood it. I mean, you understand it just by listening. If you look now into the declaration, what is stated there? It's a three-line phrase, very complex, trying to avoid this clear statement. Everyone has a right to access, to have information about human rights education, and so on and so on. Result of a, let's say, opinion-forming and decision-making process, trying to take into account different positions, different political interest groups, which were part of that process. So even if we deal with normative texts, we have to keep in mind that these are not just falling from heaven, obviously, but really part of a consensus-finding process, with its chances and with its limits. And there also the issue, for example, of blind spots come into the play. If you look at the list of possible sources of discrimination in the Universal Declaration of 1948 and lists of sources of discrimination of later human rights documents, you see differences. For example, sexual orientation wasn't an issue. I mean, obviously it was already an issue at that time, but it wasn't integrated in the Universal Declaration of 1948. In the newer human rights document, it is. So what I'm trying to say is that we need to take into account also this possibility of blind spots, which maybe later we say, well, why didn't they integrate it? And probably the next generations will say the same thing about us as well, in other specific areas. I want to ask you again, because it's getting boring if I'm always asking, if it's okay, or if you have any questions, you just ask or comment and criticize me as much as you can, okay? Perfect. The next step I would like to make with you is, after we need to consider development of texts, if you understand normative text, as I would suggest, as communication process. So a communication process between the author or authors usually and, let's say, readers, just in order not to use the same initial, and you could also call them addressees of the text, you have a communication process between the two. And for the next step, I would like to focus on the readers and authors, because they are responsible for the, and that would be the second part, the perception of a normative text. We have been looking at, let's say, the development process more focusing on the authors so far. Of course, it's an oversimplifying scheme, but maybe it's helpful to get us through this topic. If you look now at the readers and addressees of a normative text, they play a very essential role if we understand this relation as a communication process. Because if you take, for example, the perception of the two Human Rights Conventions of 1966, their perception of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights from 1948 was, for example, strongly influenced by the existence of Cold War. Probably therefore we have two documents. How would the same documents look if they would have been written in 2016? Just to give you an example. And how does the interpretation of normative texts look like if the reality is changing? If nowadays we live in a digitalized and roboticized and very much influenced by artificial use of intelligence world, that has an impact on the perception. And again, the same questions come up critically as in the case of the development of normative text. What kind of role should these historically contingent, subjective, relative influences have on the perception of normative texts? Are they legitimate? Or should we try to get rid of them and try to be as objective as possible? How much of this contextual elements, influences, are legitimate or not? And that leads me to the third point, which is contextualization. Can you give me an example of contextualization from your own professional or private life? Can be a legal text, can be a moral or ethical norm you're familiar with.
In version mode, it really depends on the period and where it's set and what happens. So I think it's one of the most contextualized now.
Yeah? Very good example. Other ideas, examples?
Even religious texts, I mean, if you want to understand the kind of language that a religious text uses, you have to understand the context in which that speech or that written text was written.
Exactly. Let's stay for a moment with, I mean, normative texts can be religious texts, they can be legal texts, they can be ethical, moral norms. So let's stick with that example. Of course, as you probably already have noticed, these steps are not separated as they seem here on the scheme. They're very much intertwining and overlapping. So for example, the perception contextualization is very much overlapping. Part of the perception, as you have described it very well, is to, and that's then mostly task of a critical exegesis of a normative text, is first really to try to understand what the authors, the original authors, tried to say. That's the first step, which shouldn't be mixed with what I see in that text. First is really a critical analysis, exegetical, well, it's tough work, it's not really funny, to really try to understand what the authors of normative texts try to tell us with them. Give you an example, if you read original Kant, Immanuel Kant texts, you have sometimes phrases over 3 pages. Not really enjoyable evening reading material. But the first step would be really to try to understand what did Immanuel Kant try to say. Always though, and that would be kind of the second aspect, being aware of the fact that it's still your perception of it. So being epistemically modest in a sense that it is an approach to it, but it won't be like the perfect understanding of what Immanuel Kant tried to say. And then after this very thorough exegetical work, you then step. And that's kind of, you can describe that, and that maybe is the first direct, explicit connection to what Julian said, is really kind of a process of listening. You try to listen to the text. What is the text telling us? That would be kind of the first step in this hermeneutical process. Listening to the text. And then, after this listening process, you examine again, and that would be the second step, you examine again if you're not just listening something in that text which you would love to listen, but if it's that really something which this text gives you. I give you an example. Often, if you deal with very difficult ethical questions, for example, in the field of science and technology nowadays, we often love to go to religious sources and try to find there the solutions for these very advanced scientific and technological problems. I'm not saying that you can't do that. I would say you can do that. But you have to be hermeneutically extremely careful how you approach it. Because it's obvious this text, which maybe were written 2,000 years ago, didn't think about the possibility of cloning. I'm not saying that there isn't anything in there which helps us to deal with the possibility, the technological capability to clone, but the step from our nowadays question, should we clone people, humans or not, to religious sources giving us advice on it, must be done very accurately and hermeneutically very much reflected, how we can do this. And first step in this process would be listening, trying to understand, do these religious texts even say something, or do these normative texts even say something about it? Second step, examine that again, so trying to see if we are really trying to read something into that text, or this text gives us something regarding our concerns. And then the third step would be to contextualize. Contextualize in the context of the authors. So what was the reason why the authors addressed this issue? Why did they address this issue, not this issue? And then in the fourth step, after contextualizing the author's perspective, we try to transfer to our reality. So it's a transfer from the reality of the authors to the reality of the addressees, of the readers of the text. What can these texts tell us today? And you could call that also contextualization of the reader's or addressee's perspective. Trying to find out, what can these texts tell us for our nowadays reality, for our question, for our specific issue, for the challenge we are dealing with? That would be the fourth step. And the fifth and last step in this hermeneutical process would be to say, well, can we somehow justify this position? What kind of reasons can we give for this normative affirmation? And in part, this justifying step is also including a re-examination if what we are pretending to find in the text is really in the text. Because by trying to justify it, we find out, well, we are kind of out of reach here. Out of track here. So that would be like five steps of a hermeneutical process in the area of between perception and contextualization. I'm not pausing because I don't have any energy anymore, but more just to give you again the possibility to criticize, comment, question, or pose questions. Doesn't seem to be the case. So then we can make the next step. Part of the contextualization is also to trying to bring normative texts into a specific reality. Trying to translate normative texts in the language, in the symbols, in the images, in the terms, in the concepts of a specific reality. I give you a concrete example, then it becomes totally clear what I mean by that. You probably have noticed that there is a growing risk or danger of a human rights violation considering taking away land from indigenous communities. usually done by multinational corporations of European and US origin. Now, what is theoretically interesting about this problem is that the victims of these human rights violations, and let's keep it simple, let's call it a violation of the right to property. The victims themselves, indigenous communities in several parts of the world, wouldn't understand this violation of their human rights as a violation of right to property, because they don't consider their land their property. They consider their relation to the land as a relation of, we have to take care of this land and then hand it over to the next generation. Now the question is, can you use the instrument of the right to property language even in a situation where the victims themselves of a human rights violation wouldn't call it that way, don't understand it that way? They would say, no, we are not able anymore, because of this land grabbing, we are not able anymore to take care of our land. But it's not a property issue. How would you approach this situation? And of course, I mean, the real situation is a little bit more complex, but just keep it simple schematically to get through this from an argumentative point of view. How would you react? If you were sitting at a table of negotiations with representatives of this indigenous community, would you just say, okay, then we just leave it and you just lose your land because we can't call it right to property violation? Or how would you approach this? Yeah, Lee?
I could answer that no matter what the name that we put for different issues, but as long as we have the same goal, I mean, in this case, mm-hmm. that both, I mean, the maybe we and the indigenous people all want to have the same goal, mm-hmm. that, yeah, bring the justice to the society. So as long as we have the same goal, we just go with it.
Mm-hmm.
And we're not
at you
with
the
name.
Yeah. Very good proposal. And also the way I would go in that situation, saying, listen, actually what is at stake is, you call it taking care of the land, we call it right to property, but at the end of the day, important is that we can protect it from this violation. And then maybe also introducing a pragmatic argument, saying we have already an established mechanism for the protection of the right to property. We don't have, and we probably won't have in the next 10, 20 years, a mechanism for protecting, taking care of the land. So therefore, maybe from a pragmatic point of view, it is more reasonable to, even if you don't call it that way, use that kind of mechanism in order to achieve, as you said, the same goal, in the sense of protecting what's at stake, basically taking care of the land, or in our understanding, or the human rights perspective, understanding property.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Couldn't you also make the argument that in terms of common law, and I don't know exactly what common law means, but that if you have lived in an apartment in Paris or on this property in some part of Australia for years without being told you must leave, it's not your property, that there's certain rights that in most parts of the world become yours, and you could make the argument for the Aboriginals that you actually have certain rights that are understood by others even though you don't understand them that way, and therefore they can be applicable.
I would, to a certain extent, absolutely agree with you. I would agree with you in the sense that probably what you were just saying is basically the normative fundament for the solution Lee proposed. Mm-hmm. Because the fundament of your proposal is basically saying, well, all humans have a right to being protected in, and from human rights, in the human rights language you would call it property, but basically it has also the impact that it's protecting, also taking care of the land.
Right, okay.
And what you were saying is basically the, let's say, legal justification why this is the case. Because a multinational corporation could say, well, I don't care about these people. Because these laws are not, this may, they may exist as legal norms, but they are not implemented in land ABC, and therefore we can do whatever we want in land ABC. Mm-hmm. But then the counter argument is exactly what you were saying. That there is a global consensus on that every human is holder of human rights. And without the condition that you understand that these are your rights, or without any other condition you have to fulfill. Mm-hmm. You don't even have to respect human rights in order to have human rights. You can be a terrorist and still keep your human rights. Because you don't have to fulfill conditions for it. So what you were saying is actually the legal justification for the solution you bring. When I gave this example of the multinational corporations, that's unfortunately not just a theoretical example, it's really the reality. I do a lot of consulting for multinational corporations. What you several times hear in board meetings is astonishing and scandalous. I had once a meeting on child labor on the production sides of these multinational corporations, and one of the board members was saying, well, I don't care. I mean, that's part of their culture, it's part of their context. We were talking about India. It's part of the context, the culture, the tradition. It's not our problem. Then I was referring to the legal dimension. He was saying, well, as long as the state of India is not, and it's just one example, I'm not blaming India, we can give other examples. If the state of India is not implementing them, we don't care. And she would just continue. Please.
Could you stay with your example? And so here you have a family and they're living on the land, but it's not property, but they live near a forest and they benefit from the forest, maybe for their wood or shade or certain plants, and that's not their property, but it's a legacy they want to pass on to future generations. Do you use the same reasoning? Where I'm going with this is, I'm taking off on what Julian said, I wanted it to be larger than the place where you're just living. Mm-hmm. I wanted to bring in environmental concerns, and so I wanted to know if you could just move it from just the domicile.
No, exactly. No, I would argue that you can say from a human perspective that the land, well, these communities are taking care of and like to hand over, it's not just the land they live on, but really also the land which is kind of their living, like the fundament of their living conditions, or the source for their existence. It keeps an anthropocentric focus, though.
It keeps a...
Anthropocentric.
Anthropocentric. Oh, anthro.
Yeah. On environment and nature. But still, it is an illegal instrument to address these issues. So, for example, if multinational corporations is destroying the environmental dimension of context, you can make that a human rights issue.
And I don't want to belabor this, but where does one then draw the boundary? Or is there any guidance about?
Well, the boundary is basically, it's a very good question, the boundary is basically if it's affecting human rights, like if you can show that, for example, polluting that river has an impact on the living conditions of this community. But that needs to be shown. If that's just a river somewhere far away which doesn't have any interaction with the community, then probably can make that argument. Not saying that there's another, you know, environmental protection reason probably to protect that river, but just, you know, from a human rights perspective, it's going to be difficult if there isn't any link with that community. That would be then probably the drawing, the line you would draw.
You were talking about contextualization, and it seems like the current reality is the contextualization is the environment and the earth and just almost everything. Is that how?
Well,
is that where, you know, human rights is, discussions are going or not?
Well, of course, the most dominant perspective is the global perspective. You know, keeping in mind that these rights are rights which we share with all humans. So you have this universal global perspective. At the same time though, and the real issues come up when you understand contextualization also in a sense that really we want to bring human rights to the context people live in, to the context which are influenced by religion, by culture, by tradition, by worldviews, by environmental realities like climate change, changing living conditions and all that. So if you want to try to bring human rights to the specific context of the individuals, there the real issues arise. And I want to just give you one example. I mean, if you just imagine, okay, community, a collective living together based on discrimination of men and women. Is it legitimate to try to change that? Or would that be part of the contextualization that you say, well, human rights would be that all are equal, but let's contextualize human rights in that context and accept that this context is practicing this since centuries and therefore we can change it. We need to contextualize, make an interpretation of human rights, including discrimination of men and women. And in order to give you time to think about it, we'll just one of my reaction to the variations and interpretation on it from music perspective you gave us, for me it sounded like two different pieces. Like, you know, two different pieces of music. In the case of the interpretations, but also in the case of the variations. So would we then, to transfer it now to the human rights issue, would you say then, in this context where discrimination of men and women is practiced on the basis of any kind of tradition, just accept that there are two kind of pieces of human rights? What would be your thoughts about that? So then I would absolutely agree with your line of argumentation. The outcome then would be that you would say, well, this context needs to change in order to create equality between men and women.
Well, I think it's a matter of dialogue. Mm-hmm. Like, it's not imposition. No. At least, you know, like, starting a dialogue. Otherwise, you can, like, it's like death penalty. Huh? You have it in certain countries based on what they think is right or wrong. Mm-hmm. But if you don't fight for a change, mm-hmm. it will keep on doing it. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it can be about anything.
Mm-hmm. Other opinions?
Well, it raises a question for me that apparently is part of the mass immigration, the refugee crisis. There are people from societies where an older man can marry someone who's 12 or 14. And it's accepted, it's part of the culture. Millions and millions live in that kind of environment. Suddenly, this husband and wife, this child wife, find themselves in Germany or Denmark where this is illegal. What happens? Do you separate husband and wife because the wife is a minor and underage and it's not permitted in the West? When you're dealing with accepting these people because of the refugee crisis and asylum-seeking responsibilities, provisions, what do you do?
Mm-hmm. Trying to link maybe what you said and what you are asking, I would introduce the distinction between the level of what should be and the level of what is, like Because, for example, the question of how we get there, like in order to avoid imposition and do the more dialogical way or using cultural mediation, is the more part of the to-be level, what is to be, like how we should get there. And the first question is, should we get there? Should we do something? That was the reason why I was asking, then should the outcome be that these contexts are changing? And that's basically the normative dimension, where you ask yourself, should it be the case that every human is equal everywhere? And I would say yes. And you can give reasons why this is the case. And then when you say, okay, that should be the goal, then you should take the next step and say, okay, and how we get there? Should we run wars for it? Invade countries? Probably not really helping, usually. In the case of humanitarian interventions, it can be justified to a certain extent. But usually like cultural mediation, dialogue, interreligious dialogue can be, but with a clear plan. I mean, I often have the impression when people say interreligious dialogue, intercultural dialogue, they often forget that people are suffering. If you run the human rights dialogue, for example, with China, people are tortured every day, hundreds, thousands. So there isn't so much time for this human rights dialogue. I've discussed that often with the Swiss government, where they say, we have this beautiful unofficial human rights dialogue. I say, yeah, but where are the results? And what is kind of time frame of really getting people out of prison, out of torture? Because they are impatient to have their situation changed. And again, giving the example of China, could give other dictators, it's not, just to give you a concrete point. So linking that with your question, and before I answer your question, give me the opportunity to just make a little parenthesis on the term mass migration crisis. I would delete mass and I would delete crisis.
Right.
Okay. For several reasons. I mean, it's not a mass phenomenon. Europe gets 1%. Mm-hmm. Maybe next year we get probably in the next 5 years, maybe get 1-2% of global migration. So it's nothing. If you discuss migration with colleagues from Singapore, from Asian countries, they just say, well, why are you behaving that way? That's such a small number. Statistically, it's not relevant. Even Germany, with this attitude of openness at the moment, it's getting statistically an irrelevant number compared to its population. For a population of 80 million, a million refugees is statistically not relevant. And it's even worse in Switzerland. I mean, we get, compared to 8 million, we get things 40,000. It's statistically not a relevant number. Mm-hmm. And I would ask governments to pretend that this is a mass thing, or an overflow, or we are threatened by that. I would really ask them for their management skills. If, for example, the Hungarian Prime Minister says we get 10,000 refugees at the weekend at the Budapest train station and we can't handle that, I would ask him to step down. Because 10,000 people are managed, coordinated, every Sunday at a soccer game. Several times of that. In Italy, 8 times of that. If you take the bigger cities. That's doable. And not even worth talking about it. Even if you look at it from an economic and financial point of view. Migration, the impact of migration, the cost this creates at the moment and probably will create then returns on this investment, the costs are not relevant. It was interesting for me to see, and that's the last part of this premise, because really it's totally about keeping time. The same day, several leaders of European countries were saying, well, we are suffering under the costs of asylum seekers and migrants and all that. The same day, the European Union officially announced that they're losing 70 billion of taxes which are not paid by multinational corporations in Europe. 70 billion. They were talking about 20 seconds in the news. 20 seconds. They were talking about 5 minutes about the costs of migration and asylum seekers. And it's just, the numbers are so different, it's so ridiculous that we give that so much attention. And therefore, I would delete also the crisis, because it's not a crisis, it's a reality. People move to get better perspectives, to get new opportunities. I move to Yale because I think that's going to be this benefiting for me. And then I will probably move to another place. I went to Rome because I thought it's a nice place to study and I can learn something there. So that's migration. We are a globalized world. So what's the problem about it? The problem about it is that we need to organize it and structure it in a decent way, which is keeping up with our own legal standards. And I'm still waiting for all the human rights cases which could be filed from asylum seekers, from migrants, which are not having their rights respected by almost all European countries. Now, coming back to your question more specifically, in the case of child marriage or forced marriage, I would say it is clear if that should be an upcoming real practice, so somebody is planning to do that, you can simply say, well, that's not allowed. And you can also argue why this is not allowed. I mean, it's also not just from a legal point of view saying, well, in our system it's not allowed, but also from a human rights perspective, you can legally and morally justify why this shouldn't be the case. Now, if that's already been pursued, then of course it's more tricky. And then it's more on the, let's say, if you have on the moral dimension the understanding that shouldn't be the case, then you would on the practical level look at possibilities to support the involved woman in getting more autonomy, more freedom as much as possible, in order to change that status, in supporting her in that position. Now, if we look at contextualization, you see the limits of context. So people say always, yeah, we need to contextualize. But if you look then what this could mean, you see the limits of contextualization. And you see also the limits for interpretation of texts. We have also examples of interpretations of human rights. We have the Bangkok Declaration, we have the Cairo Declaration of Human Rights. And there I would like to distinguish between interpretation and adaptation. Interpretation is including the possibility of change. So for example, the Cairo Declaration is, in my understanding, an interpretation of human rights, because amongst other things, it puts human rights under the condition of the Sharia. So it's basically saying, I'm simplifying now, well, human rights are in place, they are valid, as long as they're not conflicting with Sharia. So therefore, it is under the condition of Sharia, which is, in my understanding, a change of the content of human rights, because human rights are not under any religious worldview-based concept, but really are without any conditions valid, universally valid. So therefore, I would call that an interpretation instead of an adaptation, which is excluding the change of content, though contextualizing human rights to specific contexts. What I mean by that, translating it into the language of a religion, of a tradition, of a worldview. For example, the reality of this indigenous community could be an example of adaptation, saying, trying to translate the right to property language into the language of the indigenous community, which would be taking care of the land, or linking it with religious symbols in order to get people behind that idea of human rights, linking it to religious narratives, trying to bring religions and worldview-based communities on board of the human rights tradition, but within the borders of human rights, not allowing interpretations which would change the content of human rights. The Cairo Declaration is one example, the Bangkok Declaration stating human rights are in place, but states can choose their political system. Well, it's hard for me to imagine the coherence between a dictatorship and human rights. But at least in the area of the political participation rights, it's not working. So therefore, again, in my understanding, it would be an interpretation changing the content instead of an adaptation. The concept of adaptation, I've developed that in my habilitation, which I was writing on the justification of human rights in 2013. 400 pages book, no worries, we don't go through that. But what I want to point out is that adaptation is not just a one-way process. It's not just human rights criticizing religions, but also religions criticizing, or the worldview-based communities, cultures, traditions, civilizations, criticizing, participating in the human rights discourse. If you look at the drafting process of the Universal Declaration of 1948, what is interesting is that the drafters were agreeing upon the fact we shouldn't rely on a specific traditional, cultural, religious, worldview-based fundament, because that would end and limit the universality of human rights. There were attempts, for example, from the Catholic Church trying to bring God into the preamble of human rights. I think, from a retrospective, we were lucky enough that this didn't happen, because that would have been the end of the universality of human rights. But what was interesting, the drafters expressed an invitation towards religions, cultures, worldview-based communities to build the bridge from their perspective, from their religious, traditional, cultural perspective, towards human rights. Trying to locate, embed human rights in their own religious understanding of the world, in their own worldview. And allowing so the members of their communities to see the link between their own traditional and cultural background and human rights. And that's part of adaptation as well, including also justification models of human rights. So for example, you have attempts to justify human rights on a biblical basis. If you imagine that, that can be interesting for Jewish and Christians, Jewish people and Christian people, probably not so relevant for Buddhists. But I still would say an important part of adaptation. Because what is more convincing for a Jew or for a Christian than a biblical justification? And that's even more important probably, it makes a clear statement against human rights-free zones. If you keep up the idea that human rights have nothing to do with religion, or religion have nothing to do with human rights, or that human rights are a secular concept, of course, but does this secular concept doesn't have any implications for religions? Religious leaders can say, well, it's nice that we have these rights, but we have them in another world. In our religious world, we don't have them. And you don't have them. So that's what I call by human rights-free zones. Because then religious leaders can say, well, it's nice that you have these human rights in the state of Italy, but you don't have them in the Catholic Church. Or in other religions. I'm Catholic, so therefore the negative examples come also from you. Usually from the Catholic Church. So, that would be the concept of adaptation, indifference to interpretation. And adaptation would be an extremely important element in the contextualization process without changing the content of human rights. So coming back to that example of equality between a man and a woman, yes, we need to change. The change should come ideally from inside the community, and that's usually not a problem, because what we can see is that the pattern of exclusion, like patterns saying, well, it's not our tradition, it's not our culture, it's not our fathers and our mothers have already done that since centuries, and therefore we continue that practice because we were very successful with that. We can find that in any religion, any tradition, any culture, any worldview, it's these patterns of exclusion are not really linked to specific contexts, as they pretend to be. I give you two examples to illustrate that. Look at the argumentation line in the discussion about the right to vote for women in Switzerland. Switzerland introduced in the last canton, in the Appenzell Innerrhoden, in the 1990s, early 1990s, the right to vote for women was established. Not by a democratic decision, by a decision of the federal court, Swiss federal court, who had to urge and force this canton to introduce that right to vote. Because women within that canton were suing the canton because of its anti-constitutional behavior. The right to vote for women was part of the constitution already since 1974. But it took another 16 years to get that established in that specific canton. Now, why I'm giving that example? Because when you look at the argumentation line of the opponents of the right to vote for women, the arguments are, it's not our tradition, it's the Swiss way to do. We have always done that, we have been extremely successful. If we would give women the vote, the right to vote, Bolshevism would be introduced. I don't know who came up with that idea. Women are not competent to fulfill that task. Women have to play another role so that our society can still prosper and progress. If they would apply the right to vote, then they wouldn't have enough time to take care of the family. If you would ask women, they would say, yeah, we are fine with that. Please don't interfere with our internal matters. So international community, keep out of our internal stuff. So you see, and what is interesting about these patterns of exclusion, that you find them, if I do a training for the European Union with future imams in a rural area in Turkey about equality of men and women, you find the exactly same patterns of exclusion. It's not our tradition, it's blah, blah, blah. So what is interesting to see is that they pretend that these patterns of exclusion are part of their culture. But if you see that they are part of the culture in Switzerland and part of the culture in the rural area of Turkey, you may get some doubts about the fact if they're really so much context related. They're more crossing boundaries than people would argue for. So my point there is, and my argument there is, if they are not so much context related, what are the reasons for them then? So what is the line of argumentation behind these kind of affirmations? And then you understand that basically this kind of, it's our own tradition patterns of argumentation, is more like an umbrella argument in order to cover the real reasons why this is proposed. And there, adaptation comes into play. Now, there are two more steps to go, and we are 5 minutes before the end.
Well, I think we can go if it's okay with people. We started about 10 or 15 minutes late. I don't know if it's possible in people's schedules to go a little bit.
From my point of view, it's not even necessary.
Okay.
If it's, because that would be kind of what I plan to do with you. So, but of course we can keep on, but
okay.
I will finish by one and then we'll see.
Okay.
So two more steps. I just said that because I know 5 minutes before the end, before lunch, it's always tricky. So please try to keep up your energy again. We have two more steps to go. One is, I want to point out that what you notice probably is in the perception of normative texts and in the contextualization of normative texts, including adaptation instead of interpretation, the role of a corresponding ethos to legal texts is essential. Martin Luther King said in the civil rights movement, well, it's extremely important to change the laws to create equality. But you don't change a society by just changing the laws. You really need to change the corresponding ethos in a society. So the next element would be the corresponding ethos. What I mean by that is that it's really, these legal norms must be part of daily lives. They must be part of the individual existences. They must be part of their attitudes, of their way of thinking. And that's extremely hard to get there. But we often see that countries are signing human rights treaties, they're changing, they're incorporating that in their national legal systems. But if you look at the practice, it's totally different. I'll give you one example. Forced marriage is not allowed in Bangladesh, is still practiced all over. FGM is not allowed in Senegal anymore. From a legal point of view, it's practiced all over. So these are examples for this. Or equality of men and women in Switzerland is part of the legal system, but if you look at the paycheck, there's a difference between 10 to 15%. So not practiced. So that this corresponding ethics is extremely important for normative texts becoming living documents, really having an impact on the daily life of people. If, for example, you have clear legal framework, but the daily life of a person doesn't look like that, or doesn't, or it's in its life, other people don't respect them, and she or he doesn't have any possibility to change that, then something is wrong. So that would be the corresponding ethics, where all societal actors need to contribute to this corresponding ethics, too, and that's the idea of, you may have heard about the concept of the universal culture of human rights. All societal actors, in their part, contribute to a more just, a human rights respecting society. There can be, of course, the state has a place, has a role to play in that, but also multinational corporations, religious value-based communities, and individuals themselves as consumers, as parents, in their professional roles, and also arts. And that's going to be my last point, to put it up here, because it's arts, so it needs to be important. Arts is part of this societal transformation process. Because arts, let's keep with the example of music, can find different ways to bring people, to bring humans on the side of human rights, to bring them to engage for human rights, to contribute to the realization of human rights, by touching them emotionally, by moving them to become active, by encouraging them, by showing them their blind spots, by indicating them the human rights violations we are still facing. So that's where arts can contribute very significantly to the realization of human rights. And that was also recognized by the UN Declaration on Human Rights Education and Training. In Article 6.2, it says, the arts should be encouraged as a means of training and rising awareness in the field of human rights. And I really think their arts can make a significant difference. And I will want to close my presentation with really congratulating the University of Padua, in front of all you two probably, and Julia, and with the support of Mariana, to have this music and human rights seminar taking place. And thanks again so much for having me today. And I'm looking forward to some questions, if there are any comments, questions, critical remarks. Thank you so much for your attention.
Some thoughts, ideas. There's so many connections back to music that you're inspiring, and to other art forms that going to be a lot of reflection and reading on my part and others to expand this. Very invigorating. Thank you.
Legal order to make evident, more evident, that the original ontology of the human being. Yeah. I think this is not fundamentalism, this is not... So I have said bravo, the legal norm. So it's something, I think, providential, something that we have to be grateful, for instance, to the fathers and the mothers of the Universal Declaration. It was a moment of real universality in the history, courageous leaderships, wise leaderships. It happens in the history to this kind of events. Now, of course, all the discourse is absolutely useful to explain how the ontology of the human being is challenging through the legal norm cultures to expurgate the negative parts of their respective histories. Now there is a paradigm to refer to. So, this is my deep conviction.
I would share this conviction. I would, what I kind of see in my research on the relation between religions and human rights, what is kind of for me astonishing is on part is kind of that religions need to change and respect this paradigm you were describing. What is interesting is that they are actually also rediscovering that there are elements which are part of their own tradition, culture, religion, worldview, maybe which was covered for several motives over centuries, but where they see, this is actually not, that's actually something which we are familiar, they would even say, of our own. I'm a little bit critical about this over and over, because I wouldn't say that they can have this exclusive attachment to human rights, but it's interesting that they can rediscover it as something like their own.
They are, but at the beginning they were disappointed because of this event.
Yeah, definitely.
They were disappointed.
Absolutely.
Starting with the Catholic Church.
Oh, yes. And opposing the process.
Of course, the Bartolomeo de las Casas and all. It's a matter of principle, religions. As such, they do not like human rights. You have to be aware of this. Huh? But religions are cultures, cultural cultures. And they have to, in some way, to interact with it. And something is changing.
I mean, Hans Joas, the German sociologist, used the term human rights are a monument, which is just there, and people have to take a position to it. You can't just walk beside and pretend that it's not existing. It's like religious leaders make up their position towards this paradigm as you were describing. And there was once an Austrian politician who said, human rights are like the, I don't know the English term, Edelweiss. You know, this mountain flower.
And we say
Edelweiss. This white alpine.
Yes.
Sorry, but how do you call it in English?
We say Edelweiss.
Oh, perfect. Then I should have pretended that this is actually Edelweiss. No, I'm just kidding. So, and this Austrian politician said, well, human rights are actually just like the Edelweiss. It's growing and growing, and even in very, very rare and very stony and not favorable areas, conditions, it's growing and growing, and it's beautiful growing and touching people. And touching people in their heart, although the conditions for it are so bad, and you will never get rid of the Edelweiss. This awesome politician was my grandfather, so.
Ah.
I was doubting I should say that or not, but that's familiar.
So you can quote him without paying royalties.
Exactly.
But does it take a tragedy like World War II to have this wonderful outcome in 1948? And do we need another tragedy of what kind of magnitude to have people come together? Or are you saying that, hoping that because there is this normative law, and indeed even the Aboriginal peoples are now leading some of the efforts in environmental change, and people of various sexual orientations are leading the charge in certain areas, that maybe national governments and multinationals are not where the change occurs. It really can come down to individuals. I mean, individuals, whether it's a Martin Luther King or Gandhi, or individual activist in the Amazon jungle. And it's sort of what we're seeing in sort of what you're also talking about in inverting certain models of definition of citizenship, of having like European citizenship is up here and then national citizenship. But what does there need to be another huge cataclysmic? Just more
something
arts?
Something happened in 1948.
Right.
We had to foster education, information, education. This is what we should do. Relying on the human rights defenders everywhere in the world. We have this kind of new grassroots, let me say, leadership. Everywhere.
Right.
And if I'm...
No, quantity is not the same. In Saudi Arabia, for instance, is not the same like that. But also, Saudi Arabia, you have some people, some groups, more or less visible, even there. So, education, academia, schools, academic responsibility.
If I may add, I would absolutely share the recognition of the importance of education and academia research in fostering human rights realization. At the same time, the risk with relying on education, in my understanding, is that you are looking at a process of having impact maybe then in 20, 30 years. So for current victims of human rights violations, that's so much too much time. They can't have the patience for it. So I would also agree that we don't need another tragic, catastrophic, horrible event like World War II to have make a next step. I would absolutely agree with you on that. I would say it would already be enough to live up to our own standards. And not just as individuals, but also as states. I think it would give an extremely strong message to the world if, for example, Europe, in dealing with migration, would live up to the European Union Charter, to the so-called European values they are propagandizing all the time, and really show that they're serious about it. Because, I mean, for example, Guantanamo has done huge damage on human rights work by the US. The current migration, the dealing with the managing, the coordinating of migration in Europe at the moment is doing extreme damage on the European human rights work, because all over the world people are saying, well, you must be ridiculous. You preach these values for decades now, and now you're behaving like inhuman creatures. So I think it's really what we need is really action which is corresponding to the legal standards we are proclaiming to have, and concrete actions. And these concrete actions really include also making accountable multinational corporations coming from Europe and in the US for what they are doing in other countries. It's mm-hmm. just, for me, it's kind of a paradox that this is even possible to exist. That multinational corporations behave very well in Europe and the US, more or less, but on a very high level. But then they behave like slave traders and slaveholders in other countries. And we're not making them accountable for it. We're just watching it. And there are promising signs. I think there are tendencies where we had like two rulings now in UK and the Netherlands where multinational corporations coming from Europe were at least judged for remedy to human rights violations, victims. But it's still not enough. But there are tendencies in the right direction. I think in Switzerland we're going to have a vote probably next year on a so-called Konzernverantwortungsinitiative, which would be a corporate social responsibility initiative, which the main element is that you would make multinationals with headquarters in Switzerland, there are many of them, accountable in front of Swiss courts for human rights violations abroad. So it's an approach of extraterritorial legislation, which seems to be promising in my understanding. Well, the question is if it's going to be passed, because of course it's not very attractive for Swiss economy, but I'm really optimistic that it will pass and maybe can have a snowball effect to other countries as well.
Other comments? Great, well, thank you so much, Peter. Very insightful.
Thank you.
Yeah, great.